Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Hello and welcome to Retail Focus with Trent and Leighton Kling. As we discuss a rare retail IPO on this episode, we'll also discuss earnings from Coach, disappointment potentially from Tuesday morning, a bankruptcy in the grocery sector, and more news from Cerberus Capital Management as they kick the tires on Staples. But first, we begin with an earnings release from Lumber Liquidators. It is earnings season after all, and we use earnings season at the Retail Focus Podcast to get a better insight on how certain retailers are executing, where they can improve, and what areas they've been doing well. And for Lumber Liquidators, they posted first quarter earnings that were largely positive. The flooring retailer has struggled to gain back some customers since the 60-minute special, highlighting potentially dangerous levels of formaldehyde supposedly in some of their flooring. Lumber Liquidators as a stock had gained a ton of momentum over the last year, up over 100% since mid-May of last year, which was just after the 60 Minutes report came out. There were also at that time rumors of a potential buyer for the flooring giant, but nothing too substantial has come out of that, and at this point, their stock has risen to a stage where you would probably not see a buyer, particularly out of the private sector, jump in on Lumber Liquidators. It's interesting because late in this news from Lumber Liquidators was largely positive as same-store sales jumped up massively. However, shares did fall in trading after the earnings release. And as we dive into the hard numbers, we can kind of see why.
They did fall a little bit. They were around $24 a share and they fell to around $21 a share after those numbers came out. But overall, if you look in the past month or so, they've been performing very well as a stock, up quite a bit, almost 100%, in fact, since mid-May last year. You're seeing that the stock was around $11 a share during this time last year. So the company had a lot of positive momentum behind it, and I think that's why there was a lot of optimism surrounding this call. And I think that optimism was put to the side a little bit after these results came out. You see that revenue topped $248.4 million for the quarter. $233 was the revenue they got in last year, which was representative of a 6.4% rise in sales. Analysts were expecting a little bit lower sales overall, as the consensus estimates pegged second quarter revenue coming in at around $1.2 million less than it did. And then the same store sales metric, that was actually very positive for them. It came in at a positive 4.7% with a 4.8% increase in average basket and a 0.1% decrease in traffic. So traffic is basically neutral at their stores, but they're getting their customers to buy a bit more items, or at least more of those particular items that they sell. But first quarter gross margin, and gross margin is something that we wanted to focus on because this was really the story of Lumber Liquidators. We look back about 5 years ago when their stock price was trading around $30 a share. It had a bullish run because of those margins. A lot of analysts and shareholders were extremely excited because they were beating the margins of the much larger, very successful retailers in Lowe's and Home Depot. So they were really seeing a bright future, and it brought the shares up all the way to a high of around $120 a share in around November of 2013. But those margins have been taking a hit time and time again, quarter after quarter over the last year and a half. And that's because of the expenses related to the formaldehyde levels that were reported on that special 60 Minutes episode. So we're seeing that this is very cost prohibitive for them. We're seeing that those gross margins, though, are finally moving upward. And so this is a very good news point for them as they approach 35% for this most recent quarter. That's up 200 basis points from a year ago when margins were around 32.6%. And overall, I think the cost of goods metric is very solid as well. Even though the company has been forced to not source through the countries like China and other countries that had these cheaper flooring varieties, they are still able to source at a fairly adequate level. And so they're able to price things at a reasonable level in order to get some at least gross profit. But overall, we see that they did have a net loss for the quarter. And this is, again, attributed a lot to these one-time charges that the company has been having quarter after quarter related to these lawyering expenses. They had reported a net loss of $26.4 million or 93 cents per share. A narrow loss than last year, where they reported a $32.4 million loss, or $1.20 a share. Excluding those one-time charges that I've highlighted, the company yielded a per-share loss of 21 cents, and this was actually still about 2 cents per share worse than what analysts were expecting. And I think that's the one negative here. Even though revenue and same-store sales are very strong and they've grown their store unit count, which is something we'll talk about a little later, they still have not been producing those bottom-line results that really is probably the most important metric if you're a shareholder of this company and have remained one for some time.
Part of that, as you mentioned, some of the, as they call them, legacy legal issues still existing from 2014 and 2015. And we've talked about how much that's hamstrung Lumber Liquidators over the past couple of years, and specifically over the past 4 to 6 quarters. This quarter, to put it into exact terms, the company paid $18 million in items related to resolving this issue. But they want to hit the reset button from this point on forward. And when we look at Lumber Liquidators as a company, we see a company that's still potentially primed for growth in a number of ways. First, the company has begun to sell tiles in some of its locations. And I think this is, if you were to delve into it, one of the reasons for the increased basket size or the increased receipt size per transaction, despite the fact that transactions aren't going up at these stores or the number of transactions aren't going up. You're seeing receipt size build in part because they're mixing in tiles. Some tiles are a higher dollar item than some of their hardwoods, especially their value-priced hardwoods like their bamboo, for example. So this builds into their overarching concept. Additionally, tiles are becoming increasingly popular for uses in kitchens and bathrooms during remodels. And management said that these ceramic tiles that they're selling, a small but growing sector in terms of its sales, that its sales of engineered bamboo also helping the company's product mix, as it tends to come with slightly higher margins. When we talk about other companies in this sector having success, oftentimes tile, marble, granite, those materials play into it. And the Tile Shop is a company we have seen do exceedingly well over the last couple of years, but really even over the last 5 years. Their showrooms have started concentrating in the larger metropolitan areas of the country. And again, tile is a product that you're going to get a higher receipt price for than a lot of the bargain hardwoods that Lumber Liquidators tends to sell for. And they can charge a little bit more than they do for their engineered hardwood or even some of their bamboo flooring, even though they do get pretty high margins on that bamboo flooring. Selling, general, and administrative costs were nearly $5 million down this year, too, at Lumber Liquidators versus the same quarter last year. However, this year's first quarter and last year's first quarter were also inflated with settlement costs and the other one-time charges that we've already alluded to. So it's tough to tell from an outsider's perspective if they're actually being more efficient in this cost category, but it's always a good thing when you see costs go down in selling, general, and administrative expenses, as long as your top line revenue continues to go up, which again it did for Lumber Liquidators in this first quarter. The company did note that they're spending more in payroll. This is not a new concept, as we've talked regularly about wage inflation here on the show. They are staffing a bit more to try and accommodate the different sections. And of course, whenever you add a different material, like in tile, for example, you've got to train new employees there. You've got to bring in additional employees to help to staff those areas. It's a lot like JCPenney beginning to include appliances. You have to either move some staff over to be appliance specific or staff your store with additional employee or team members. The total increase in payroll for this first quarter versus the previous year's first quarter is $5.3 million. But again, Layton, I think when you see a store that's increasing their payroll because they're increasing on staffing levels, that is usually indicative of a store that eyes themselves as still being in a growth phase or transitioning into a growth phase, whereas one that is shrinking back and having to curtail staff levels on the floor.
So I think there's a couple things working here for them, and that increased staffing at individual locations will actually give the customers the ability to make the right decisions. And I think overall, and this is something, a term that's actually used a lot in online and e-commerce, but I think you're going to see that the companies have a higher conversion rate overall when you have higher staffing levels. I know personally, just going to any general merchandise retailer, it's a little bit frustrating if you're looking around but don't know exactly what you're looking at. And I think Lumber Liquidators eyes this as an opportunity to differentiate themselves. You look at a company, again, like Lowe's or Home Depot, and you're seeing a lot of store associates, but not a lot of them are experts. And with a niche like flooring, where you're only selling a certain number of products and a certain type of home improvement product, you can really come off as your local expert. And I think that's really what they're trying to do here. They've also implemented some good training programs for their associates to really imply that they are knowing what they sell and how to install it and things of that nature, really helping the people out that come into their individual locations. And as with those locations, I had mentioned they are still increasing the overall store count. We see that they opened two locations during the first quarter, and the company now has 385 locations across all of North America. And they aren't really shy about saying and claiming that they're North America's largest specialty retailer of hardwood flooring. So again, bullish on the hardwood flooring. I am curious to see if they build out their tile mix in the future quarters. We see the continued success from other retailers like the Tile Shop that carries specifically tile and higher margin items. But overall, we see that the company, like I said, is down a little bit from their highs of around $24 a share over the past month. They initially fell around 13% as a stock, but have since rebounded slightly. They're trading around $21 a share currently. And really, we have to keep in mind that all-time high that they achieved in 2013 of $120 a share. So I think if you read a lot of articles out there, you can get some mixed feelings about Lumber Liquidators from the financial perspective. But just know that the company is fundamentally the same despite those profit misses. I think that overall, the company is operating at a very high level with even more locations than they had in that time frame. So I think there is a lot of white space for the company, but they have to get profitable and they have to get past those one-time charges.
Well, Lumber Liquidators has plenty of growing competition in this space. Not only do they have the likes of Home Depot and Lowe's, and of course, smaller operators in certain circumstances like Ace and True Value. We mentioned the Tile Shop, but now a relatively new company has just completed its IPO. A competitor to Lumber Liquidators in Floor and Decor Holdings is now publicly traded on the New York Stock Exchange under the stock symbol FND. There haven't been a lot of IPOs this year, specifically not a whole lot of retail IPOs over the last several years. And Floor and Decor really impressed in their initial public offering as the stock absolutely jumped. We'll talk about that in a moment. As we look overall at the initial public offering landscape for 2017, Snapchat or Snap comes to mind as one IPO that had a lot of excitement build up around it as a potential competitor to other social media companies such as Facebook and Twitter. Snap currently has about a $25 billion valuation in terms of market cap, but doesn't have any profit, so hasn't shown a profit yet, let alone any high-level revenue. So they have this massive market valuation because there was all this excitement built up here. But when you look at Floor and Decor, there was a lot of investor enthusiasm surrounding them during their IPO, which I think is positive, certainly, especially for us when we cover the retail industry. We hear so much about the retail industry struggling. That's not the case for this particular business. Shares are now around $36, even coming close to $37 per share on the day we're recording the podcast, May 4th. They've jumped 71% since emerging onto the scene, giving the company about a $3.36 billion valuation, or for reference, about 1/8 of Snap's valuation, despite the fact that Floor and Decor so far is profitable. Upon closing of its initial public offering of over 10 million shares of its common stock at a public offering price of $21 per share, you saw the stock prices increase precipitously. In the initial press release indicating the intent for an IPO, the company said it expected to have an offer price between $16 to $18 per share. So they ended up getting substantially more cash, and the market seems quite bullish on Floor and Decor. Leighton, why don't we explain to our listeners a little bit about Floor and Decor and the background here?
Yeah, so I'm pretty sure the company is excited about getting a $3 to $5 per share premium from their original anticipated offer price of that $16 to $18 per share. And the back of the napkin math tells us that's around $30 to $50 extra million dollars the company will now have on the back end. And it really is up to the company as to how to deal with that extra cash. But yes, we will talk about the company and really a little bit of a brief background as they are emerging onto the scene, and quite rapidly actually, as the company was founded in 2000 and is headquartered in Atlanta, Georgia. What struck us as funny is both Lumber Liquidators and Floor & Decor are claiming to be market leaders in the flooring category in North America. And if you see a statement quote from their website, you see that they say Floor & Decor is a leading specialty retailer in the hard surface flooring market, offering the broadest in-stock selection of tile, wood, stone, related products, and flooring accessories at everyday low prices. And from that statement, Trent, we can really glean that they are more than just a hardwood flooring retailer, and that they do have the tile and stone offerings as well, something that Lumber Liquidators, oddly enough, is just now getting into. And it's funny because Lumber Liquidators is actually a little bit older of a company. They're 7 years older, to be exact, as they first entered the market here in the United States in 1993. But overall, you do look at a footprint with Floor & Decor that is quite large. We're looking at around an average of 72,000 in square footage per location. That is much, much larger than the showrooms that Lumber Liquidators have across the country. They average around 6,000 to 8,000, according to their website, in square footage. But if you compare them to a larger Lowe's or Home Depot, they're about 50 to 30,000 square feet less in space overall. But like all home improvement stores, they do have two core customers: the homeowner that is doing those single projects that are a little bit smaller in size, and the contractors that are doing that larger work and are frequently buying more overall. Their mix of products, as I said, does seem to be a key differentiator in that they don't have as broad of a selection as a Lowe's or Home Depot, but they have probably 2 to 3 times more offerings than that of a Lumber Liquidator. So they do have a deep selection of that tile and that stone, but they also have what they call decoratives, which are specialty tile sets for smaller projects, and they highlight these very well on their website. If you go to flooranddecor.com, they actually list all the different tile and stone first, which is not to say that the wood flooring isn't just as big of a piece of their overall business, but they really are emphasizing the different works they do and what you can do with their specialty offerings. So overall, we have seen a lot of growth from this company, but as with many successful companies, growth didn't come easy and it did not come immediately with Floor & Decor. We see that after about a decade of calculated expansion, the company began to look into how to accelerate their store presence. And with that, we see an explosion in revenue. And just in the last 5 years, they've actually almost tripled their revenue coming in, according to their filings before the IPO date. They now have around $772 million in revenue. That was at the end of calendar year 2016. So a very profitable company too. You look at not only revenue, but the bottom line, as they have a reported $26 million in net income from that year I had cited, 2016. And even though they are a smaller concept overall, it seems as though they are primed for even more growth after this IPO.
One of the things that caught our eye regarding the company when they were growing over the last 4 to 5 years is the square footage. The fact that they are just over 70,000 square feet puts them in a unique position in the marketplace. And when, as Leighton mentioned, you've got a store that's slightly smaller than a Home Depot, yet a little bit more focused as far as what they carry, I think that is a powerful message to consumers. And they're one of these hyper-specialized retailers that seem to be having more success than the general merchandise retailers are, and certainly more than the department store retailers are. And I say that noticing that certainly Home Depot, Lowe's, and even on into True Value, pretty much anyone in the home improvement sector is having a lot of success at this stage. However, because of this square footage, and if we assume that they're going to use part of the capital that they've opened up to try and expand their footprint in the United States, it's going to be difficult for them to reuse a lot of real estate that's out there. H.H. Gregg Stores are a company that we mentioned closing down a number of locations. And you might ask, well, can Floor & Decor use some of those real estate holdings? H.H. Gregg, the average one, about 30,000 square feet, so less than half what a typical Floor & Decor store is. What's more, as you look at Kmart stores, they're closing in a number of locations. Their buildings are a little bit too big. They're around 90,000 square feet or even larger than that. But I do see when you look at the Floor & Decor landscape, when you look at how they've laid out their stores with a contractor pickup on one end, I do see where they might be able to reform some Kmarts, especially Kmarts that are still in burgeoning commercial areas. But there is the other problem, of course, that you have with a number of Kmarts, which is that, honestly, that particular franchise under Sears Holdings has not kept up with where the retail centers of towns are moving. So if Floor & Decor is set on being in high traffic areas, as you have with a lot of Home Depot, Lowe's, and even tile shops and lumber liquidators, that could present an issue for them. Now, if they're content with getting real estate maybe at a little bit more of a budget price and they're not so concerned about where they're at within a city because they know they're a destination for people that are renovating or for contractors, then maybe they can snatch up some of that real estate and tinker with it and churn out something that is much more their style at around that 72,000 square feet. And I think the biggest question here surrounding the entire chain during this IPO is, what are they going to use the capital for? One of the things that they got out in front of the rumors about was the fact that they were going to use some of the capital to pay off some long-term debt. However, the company is profitable since they did have $26 million in net income in 2016. So in theory, they've got a lot of money to spend. And the question is, where does it go and how quickly do they spend it?
One of the things that really struck me as interesting is they only mentioned the fact that they're going to be paying off some of those long-standing loans in terms of their loan facility that they took out. So they really did not mention actually growing their store footprint or trying to remodel any of their stores. But some of those larger retailers that are exiting the market, namely H.H. Gregg and Kmart, if you're looking at the general square footage that they may be eyeing, it may not be a big issue, Trent. I think that's one of the excellent points you brought up, and that I think a lot of that undeveloped real estate or the vacant real estate out there in terms of the commercial properties that are left vacant, you're seeing that there's going to be a lot of opportunity in terms of potentially lesser rents. You're looking at rents per square footage are going to be a little bit less. And I was just reading some articles talking about some Kmarts that actually closed down here recently, and those developers are really clamoring to redevelop them into strip malls so you can have a multi-tenant space. And I think H.H. Gregg could come along and say, listen, we can actually save the developers some money, at least in the short to mid-term, by entering into a very beneficial agreement. It helps the developer out and the owner of the property, and it ends up helping them out by getting their brand out there at a fairly cheap cost. So despite having larger stores out there like Kmart's that can even go up to around 120,000 square feet, which is some of the research I had done, some are as small as 80, but you're looking at a huge opportunity here to expand from the southwestern United States where they do have the highest concentration of their stores. They had mentioned Georgia and Florida being two of the states that they have the most amount of stores in, but if you look at the recent closings from these retailers that we just named, they're all across the country. So really a ton of white space for a flooring leader that could really make an entrance here and compete with lumber liquidators.
One final note on Floor & Decor before we move on to our next earnings call is that they have an excellent buy online, pickup in store option on their website. Their website is extremely functional. It allows everyone visiting to customize their options and get items picked up either in store or delivered to their home. And that's something that oftentimes we discuss with new and emerging retailers, the fact that they have grown along with e-commerce. And so their buy online, pickup in store options are more native to their website. They're using their distribution efforts to attempt to connect the user with this material, and whether the user wishes to have it delivered to their home or wishes to pick it up in store, they're willing and able to accommodate that for nearly every single item on their website. And I was tinkering around with their website, testing their website and their buy online pickup in store options, and it is reasonably universal throughout just about every single product. And this is an advantage that they may have over the likes of Lowe's and Home Depot as well, who are still trying to work out that buy online pickup in store option and extend that to all products.
Well, we move on with a luxury retailer that I'm sure Trent is extremely excited to talk about. This with Coach, as they reported better than expected earnings, giving out several pieces of good news to analysts this week amidst acquisition talks. This was their third quarter and was reported on Tuesday after the closing bell. The luxury retailer reported earnings of 46 cents per share, and this actually included one-time items. And this on sales of $995 million for the third quarter. They missed that $1 billion mark, but analysts were expecting Coach to get earnings of around 44 cents per share, meaning they actually beat on the profit side of things by 2 cents per diluted share. This was the downside, however. Revenue came in slightly below what analysts were expecting. Analysts were expecting $1.019 billion, and this according to a Thomson Reuters consensus estimate. The retailer has been a source of negative attention as the luxury space has drawn the ire of media outlets claiming that high-end retail may be the hardest hit when it comes to the general downturn in brick-and-mortar stores. Coach is adjusting its strategy, however, at least in the short to mid-term. Their CEO, Victor Luis, said in a statement on the conference call after the earnings press release came out that the solid financial performance was indeed a result of strong strategic shifts in the company's management scheme. The company will look to largely do away with promotional discounts that it had been known for over the past couple of years. They're trying to increase traffic by having these promotional discounts. But it appears as though, even though traffic numbers were fairly solid, these were actually hurting their margins. And really, the question is if they're going to be able to sell through merchandise as much without these promotional discounts in the long run. But Coach will continue to also tightly control costs as part of a measure to ensure those healthy gross margins. So it's not just an alternative to have one thing taken away, but they're actually looking at a multitude of issues here in order to maintain those gross margins that they've been known for a long time. Gross margins, of course, is a thing that a lot of luxury retailers often look at when deciding whether or not to continue on with a particular strategy, because gross margins is the most important facet of their business. If they become an off-price retailer, they are no longer considered luxury by the larger, broader market.
Something I also find intriguing in regards to Coach is that they're making investments in other areas as well, especially online sales, where customers of higher end merchandise were thought to maybe peruse a little bit less when evaluating style and quality, but they're doing a pretty good job in building out their e-commerce platform, and they're making other investments into the brand as well. They have several new management appointments, including Giovanni Morelli, who joined the brand this week as their creative director. With Morelli coming on board, it underscores the fact that Coach is paying very careful attention to design, which is something that's often forgotten when talking about high-end products in the fashion industry. Now, design was in the news a lot over the past week as Nordstrom came under fire for selling mud-caked or faux mud-caked jeans. But when we talk about design being forgotten, it's forgotten in the sense that it does take a lot of resources in order to try and get a differentiated quality product to the store shelves. And as much as Nordstrom came under fire for those particular jeans, you cannot argue that it wasn't a differentiated product. And every time an item in luxury retail comes under fire, it typically sells out quickly thereafter. It's really about differentiating rather than delivering something that everyone in the media will agree with when you're in high-end or luxury retail. We see that many brands try to scoop up up-and-coming designers. Morelli, you could make an argument, not an up-and-coming designer in that he's been around for a long time, but he has gained prominence elsewhere, and so it's important for Coach to try and bring him in to make sure they are building out their design part of what they sell, and also to make sure that they have a differentiated product. Another new appointment for coach is Josh Schulman. He'll join coach next month in the newly created role of coach, brand president, and CEO. So this is a brand new role. He's currently the president of Bergdorf Goodman, which is a Neiman Marcus subsidiary. Bergdorf Goodman has two stores in Manhattan. Now, this is a role for Schulman at Bergdorf Goodman that he's held since May of 2012. He's held previous roles with Kenneth Cole as well. And this is an interesting call for coach because Neiman Marcus has come under fire recently. Although they're not a publicly traded company, they do release a lot of financial information on their website. And just for their last quarter alone, same-store sales were down over 6%. Revenues down also over 6%. And they don't split out revenues between their 42 Neiman Marcus stores and their two Bergdorf Goodman stores and, of course, all of their off-price offerings. But generally speaking, Neiman Marcus has been struggling over the last 12 to 18 months. And I find it intriguing that Coach has swooped in and picked up the previous president of Bergdorf Goodman to bring them in, to bring him in into their portfolio of leadership. And although I think on the outside you could be critical of the call, it's a good move for Schulman because who knows where Neiman Marcus is going in the years ahead as their revenue continues to dwindle. We don't know what plans they have for the Bergdorf Goodman stores in Manhattan. But also, we don't know how those particular stores were performing. It could well be that the Bergdorf Goodman stores in Neiman Marcus's portfolio were performing in a strong fashion. This is something that Coach was able to see and therefore able to make a play on a person in a leadership position that might be a little bit of a market inefficiency where more people had thought that Neiman Marcus as a whole had been struggling. They're also expanding their retail selection, is Coach. Their popular 1941 collection is growing. There's a greater mix of wallets, handbags, other leather accessories that's tied to their sub-brand. They're also building out their T. Rose platform within 1941 as well, so kind of a platform within a sub-brand there. Trying to acknowledge new and upcoming consumer trends, trying to stay on trend with the color combinations in their T. Rose platform. They've combed through other older items, adjusted aspects, eliminated some that affect functionality. They're looking at the overall size of certain handbags and trying to optimize those for the luxury consumers of today. And finally, they're pretty bullish on pushing more seasonal items, which is something that you see for a retailer like Neiman Marcus or Nordstrom, but to this point is not something that had been built out to a larger extent within Coach. They feel like they can gain from having special limited time holiday collections that emphasize their brand. And like I said, this has worked in the past for other luxury retailers, and this does drive additional sales. Even if you have routine customers that come in and purchase certain items or certain lines or items within a certain line, they will come in during these seasonal sales and splurge on these additional items. So anytime you can bring in your regular customers for seasonal purchases and maintain an awareness of seasonality through your retail selection, that's a positive, and it's an easy, kind of low-hanging fruit way to build out your retail sales without having to jump through too many hoops.
Yeah, I think that's a great strategy. And if you look, too, at the customers who come in a little more frequently and not just for those sale items, they're really going to splurge when they see a limited time offering on something that may not be there at that particular location in just a week's time. So I think it drives the idea of scarcity with their products. And overall, that's going to end up boosting their brand for the long term. We talk about scarcity a lot in the retail industry, and that's really something that drives prices up. If the overall demand for something is there and you know that there's going to be a very low supply of it, it's going to help not only the brand, but really those margins too at the end of the day. We move on to how they are building out their brick and mortar presence. Again, this really has been in the news as luxury retail overall has been targeted by the media as something that's going to be hard to maintain a profitable stance in. We're talking about high rent malls and things of that nature. But if you look here into the details with their brick and mortar presence, Just over the last quarter, they renovated and opened 50 locations, and this includes 17 directly operated locations in North America. So retail and brick and mortar is not dead, and they're looking at having 600 modern luxury locations globally across all channels. And something here that I wanted to talk about briefly was, I think the appointment by Josh Schulman may have been because they are renovating their locations. They're talking about how this is going to be a main driver of positive comps in the future. They're realigning these locations to make way for some additional space. They talked about elevating customer service, but they also want the ability to hold special customer events throughout the year inside of these stores. So obviously you're going to need a little bit more open space in order to do that. But they said that based on the renovations and the increased customer experience initiatives they've brought forth, that they actually have some more favorable experience metrics to go by. They mentioned some secret shopper scores. And according to the comments from management on the conference call, this last quarter, they received an 85% favorable experience rating versus 75% during the same quarter last year. So obviously, whatever they are doing, it is working down to the store level, at least as far as these same scores are concerned. And lastly, we discussed their marketing initiatives. They have recently partnered with Selena Gomez, who obviously has a massive social media following on multiple platforms. On Instagram, she actually ended up posting two coach-related pictures. And during the first quarter, the company was excited to see that they had each received over 5 million likes, one 5 million likes and the other around 6 million likes to be exact. She is also collaborating on a new handbag per the company, which is going to give them a little bit more brand presence with the Selena Gomez brand. And you're looking at a company that says that she is the new face of the brand, which is a bold statement to say the least. It's unclear as to how the conversion rate, however, with the partnership has done thus far. I had mentioned those two Instagram posts where she is posting some coach-related items. And it's interesting because you mentioned how the partnership is receiving a lot of enthusiasm. A lot of people are recognizing the partnership, but these are going to be the important metrics and how they're able to turn over merchandise from these ads. Obviously, this partnership is probably not going to be the cheapest, but overall, it has to end up driving online sales at least in order to be a sustainable partnership for the long term. We talk about the stock growing. The shares surged around 7.5% on the news, and really, we see the shares around $43 a share currently, surpassing the trailing 52-week mark. Shares, however, are still down around 40% if you extend and broaden that time frame over the last 5 years. We see that shares really have struggled, but overall we see that the company has performed better in the luxury space than some of its competitors.
We continue in the second segment of the Retail Focus podcast with more news surrounding Cerberus Capital Management, as multiple news outlets have reported a potential interest in buyout of publicly traded Staples. We have discussed at length Staples' struggles over the past 18 months, including their fall through after their deal with Office Depot and Office Max did not go through. Cerberus Capital Management, for those that are not familiar with them, they're a private equity firm that have a number of retail holdings. We discussed them last week with regards to a potential Whole Foods buyout. They've already reportedly offered to take Sprouts private, and they own Albertsons and Save-A-Lot, among others. What's interesting for Cerberus is that they just raised a $4 billion round of funding for another venture that is mostly separate of retail. And we talked last week in the discussion surrounding Cerberus and Whole Foods about the fact that they probably don't have a ton to work with. They have $30 billion total under management, but most of that is already invested elsewhere. And with Staples, the price may be a little bit too high for Cerberus to manage. Overall, though, this capital management firm has been tied into a number of different businesses as they appear hungry to expand their holdings.
And as it relates to that $4 billion round that was actually closed at the beginning of April, this multi-strategy fund has brought in investors of all backgrounds and will be focused on non-performing loans, corporate credit and distressed debt, mortgage securities and assets, but they did mention private equity. And obviously, this is a huge caveat here in that private equity, the term private equity, can pretty much be considered as anything tangible. Obviously, private equity won't fall under the umbrella of non-performing loans and things of that nature, but private equity can pretty much mean anything, any sort of business that runs an operation, either in the service or product sector. So one may wonder, really, if they're going to be able to use this cash for some sort of acquisition like this. However, you would look at the value, that $4 billion value that round gave in there, and compare that to the market valuation of Staples, which right now currently is recording this podcast is around $6.2 billion according to its stock price. And so you're looking at a company that may in fact not have even the amount of cash it would take to buy Staples, and that's at the current market rate. So typically you see a buyout offer that's going to have a premium on it, 15 to 20%. Even a 10% premium would really put this out of the hands of Cerberus Capital Management, unless they either partner with somebody or are able to get some new credit into their hands. But overall, you see that this is an interesting story because they're really looking potentially at buying just a piece of this company. Staples overall has not only a retail operation, but then also their wholesale sector where they're able to sell certain items to businesses. They have those business-to-business partnerships. So potentially they could buy just a piece of Staples and really make that the area of focus, leaving the retail behind, or do the opposite, buy the retail in hopes of making that a profitable area for the business, keeping Staples wholesale under that division. So I am curious to see what happens here. But again, I think if you look at what the analyst statements were saying from this, I think the big issue here is liquidity. There's also another private equity firm that is interested here. The other firm is Sycamore Partners, which has also been mentioned in retail through our stories in the past, and they don't have as much cash either. They're really only holding around $3 to $5 billion in assets under management. So I am curious to see what happens here, as Staples still has around 1,200 stores inside the United States and around 304 stores in Canada.
You mentioned the idea that they may indeed sell off their wholesale division. I think this is a dangerous circumstance for Staples because that overall, their wholesale and services and their contract side of the business seems to be the more successful side of Staples, and it might be a little bit more difficult for them to divide that from their retail branch. Now, the argument for doing that is that they would be able to focus on their retail branch, which has been struggling over the past several years. It's certainly seen better times, especially since the easy button turnaround of the mid-2000s. They've recently closed hundreds of locations, most of those coming after the Office Depot merger got shot down. Staples still has a ton of stores in the U.S., 1,255 stores overall in the U.S., 304 stores in Canada. So they have a massive reach in Canada, have a lot more Canadian stores than just about any other North American retailer in this particular segment. They did recently announce plans to close another 60 stores in North America, but one of the things that we've been talking about is their ability to unlock value from what they see as larger, unnecessarily large square footage in their stores and in their North American holdings. Potentially, acquisition from a capital management firm or a private equity firm, while it would give them different leadership and they would no longer be publicly traded, you're absolutely right, Leighton, when you talk about liquidity. Would it give them the liquidity that they need to unlock in order to tap into some of this value that they're seeing from the square footage? We're talking about things like temporary offices, different areas to better serve their consumers, almost similar to having a FedEx Kinko's in-house within the Staples. It's somewhat questionable if a private equity firm just needs to raise that much money in order to purchase Staples, whether or not there would be a long-term benefit provided from the capital of a private equity firm and whatever infusion that took place to Staples.
From an operational standpoint, it is even more interesting when you look back to the last quarter that Staples reported on March 9th, where top line revenue contracted 3% year over year. The bigger issue here is those operating losses, and I would have to believe that this is the number one reason Staples is looking for a private equity firm or any firm to take over at least part of their operations, because they are not able to make strategic changes enough in the company to make profitability happen. And you look at where they are trying to plug the leaks, it seems as though the strategic alternatives that the company is making both in store and on their e-commerce platform just are not working. And you look back at that quarter, that fourth quarter, they reported a GAAP loss of a whopping $615 million on that $4.6 billion in sales. So a company that is truly unprofitable, and I doubt they'll have any good quarters to come in 2017. But as a stock, oddly enough, this was basically unchanged on the news, most likely due to the fact that there was a lot of uncertainty and vagueness baked into the story overall. A lot of caveats in there, a lot of open-ended questions. But shares are currently trading around $9.16 a share, slightly up from the beginning of the year, but it has been a volatile 6 months. If you look back since December, shares have been up and down, and a lot of pessimism built into Staples as a company. We end with sad news as independent grocery operator Central Grocers has officially filed for Chapter 7 bankruptcy. Their CEO cited an increasingly difficult environment for independent grocers here in the United States. Not only is Central Grocers an operator of two different grocery store banners in Strack and Van Til, but also Ultra Foods, but they operate a massive wholesale operation out of Illinois as well. And we will talk about both and how this concerns both areas of the business. But in addition to their supplying of their own stores, they also supply over 400 different grocery stores, both independent and larger privately and publicly owned grocers in the Chicago area near where they are based. At the beginning of the year, Central Grocers was the seventh largest grocery cooperative in the United States. They distribute and package over 40,000 items in total, including produce, meat, and some dry goods. However, if you go on their website, particularly the wholesale side of operations, it appears to be mostly deli items that they specialize in. They're headquartered in Joliet, Illinois, which is actually a town just southwest of Chicago. And it appears as though they are actually under this involuntary bankruptcy through several of their creditors claiming that they're owed over $1 million, Trent.
Yes, and these creditors that have triggered this involuntary bankruptcy are names that a lot of people are going to know. These are names of companies that provide goods usually to grocery wholesalers. We have at least four: Coca-Cola Company, General Mills Incorporated, Mars Financial Services, and Post Consumer Brands. These four have filed an involuntary case in U.S. Bankruptcy Court's Northern District of Illinois in an attempt to recoup their debt. Now, this is a Chapter 7 bankruptcy, which is different than the more common Chapter 11 that has come up with other retailers in the recent past. So you have Chapter 7 versus Chapter 11 bankruptcy. The main difference here is under Chapter 7 bankruptcy, the lender and the creditors get the proceeds from the debtor's liquidation sales. So right here, Coca-Cola, General Mills, Mars, and Post Consumer Brands are doing this in an attempt to recoup the money essentially that they are owned by Central Grocers and by this chain, and they're seeking to do so through liquidation. In Chapter 11, the company, instead of selling off, liquidating, and then giving the money back to their creditors, the company can actually restructure, renegotiate with creditors, push some of that debt more towards the long term in order to keep some or all of their operations going. Sometimes this can even involve selling off some assets to the creditors themselves. And usually Chapter 11 ends in liquidation only when a certain bidder for assets cannot be found, or as we've talked about in the past, a stalking horse bid is actually awarded to a liquidation firm. In this case with Central Grocers, it appears as though they owe at least $1.8 million to the vendors that we named, with the bulk of the balance coming from General Mills with $1.1 million. And looking at this at a macro level, Leighton, I'm honestly kind of surprised that these suppliers went to this step to try and get this $1.8 million back, because in the scheme of things, that $1.8 million doesn't seem like a ton, especially considering the amount of business that Central Grocers does in the Chicago metro area.
Absolutely. And if you just take a quick glance at their distribution center, you can see it's just massive. And reportedly, Central Grocers is actually over or near a $2 billion business overall. And so when we're talking about $1.8 million in debts, or at least that's what we're aware of from these filings, it's really not that much, Trent. So it is interesting that these vendors are trying to force their hand here and force this Chapter 7 on Central Grocers. But as for that distribution center, it appears that they have not found a buyer and will have to auction it off. And this came off of a news report just hours before us recording this, but this would potentially put around 549 people out of work. And you see a statement from Central Grocers CEO Ken Nemeth. He said, at present, no potential buyer has stepped forward who intends to operate the facility on an ongoing basis as a distribution center. And therefore, we do not expect that any potential purchaser will be making offers of employment to the employees employed at that property. And if you actually look at that area as a whole, this is one of the main employers. And I think this is really going to hurt the local economy. And I think that's why there was a push to keep this facility open, Trent, at least in the short term. You see that 400 of those 549 employees are actually part of the Teamsters Union as they drive the trucks, the distribution trucks that come out of that distribution center. But it is clear that the facility is at least going to remain open for 6 to 8 weeks. So I think that overall, the management is hopeful that somebody comes forth and at least wants to do something with the factory and not just leave it stagnant. But you see that the retail operations are still going to be alive. They have closed at least 14 stores this year, but they currently still have 22 Strack and Van Til stores left. And management actually came out with a statement saying, our stores are not closed. So they want to make sure and not diminish those individualized sales at those stores. They don't want any negative press releases to come out to make customers think that they have indeed closed those operations as well. So as it stands, it appears as though the distribution center operations and their remaining stores, the retail stores there in those areas, are going to remain alive. However, we will be looking over this situation very closely in the coming weeks. Hopefully, as we've noted prior in other bankruptcies, both Chapter 11 and Chapter 7, it always ends up being for the best if they can at least allow some operations to continue, because it is important that they stay gainfully employed in these local areas and very important for that local economy, because obviously that trickle-down effect will affect more than just those jobs at the distribution center, but obviously any ancillary jobs that are associated with those people being employed.
You talked about us keeping an eye on it over the next couple of weeks. We don't even need to wait that long as we get more breaking news just now, which is that Central Grocers has actually kind of flipped the script and they're applying for Chapter 11 bankruptcy as part of this plan to lay off 550 or so employees. And they've mentioned that they are trying to keep the retail stores open. Strack and Van Til is a chain that has been shrinking drastically over the past several years. Just 3 years ago, I actually visited a Strack and Van Til store that was being liquidated or was in the process of closing down, where they were selling off a lot of goods there. They closed down a number of their Strack and Van Til stores last year. And then last month, as Layton talked about, Central Grocery announced plans to sell 22 of the Strack and Van Til stores while closing 9 underperforming Ultra stores. Now we get an update in addition to this Chapter 11 bankruptcy filing that the company said it expects to enter into a sales agreement for 19 of the Strack and Van Til stores soon with a stalking horse bidder, whom we just talked about, usually includes some sort of a liquidation firm. So in likelihood, not 100%, but usually the likelihood with a stalking horse bidder in retail is that it is a liquidation firm. If that's the case, then you'll have those 19 stores closing as well. But this also makes things difficult for all these independent grocers that were stocked by Central Grocers because of their distribution agreement. So it's going to make things difficult for some of the mini marts, some of the independent grocery stores in the greater Chicago metro area to try and stay open or at least replace their distribution network, swapping out Central Grocers with another respected brand. And it could have a lasting impact on those those as well. One particular store in the Chicago Metro, Sunset Foods, apparently recently inked a deal with Super Value instead of working with Central Grocers. Super Value, which is a brand that we just talked about recently getting increasingly into the wholesale game, has swooped in and will begin to distribute some of those brands that Central Grocers will leave behind. All of this happening very, very quickly. It was within a 24-hour span that we heard of the involuntary Chapter 7 bankruptcy that the four suppliers were lobbying for, and now Strack and Van Til themselves declaring Chapter 11 bankruptcy, the future of their stores, and definitely the future of their distribution center, very much up in the air.
Anytime you see a lot of action in a short period of time, that means there is some underlying value in the assets that they hold. So I am curious to see how much exactly of the remaining operations are going to be intact when looking back a year from now. So I am curious, too, to see if those other operators are going to be maybe interested in taking a piece of their current sites. We talked about Cerberus Capital really trying to take advantage of companies that they feel are undervalued. So I am curious to see if another operator potentially in the same sector comes in and maybe takes a piece of the action.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
Well, we close out this edition of the Retail Focus podcast by each telling you one story that we're keeping an eye on over the next week or the next month. And as is tradition, we begin with Leighton.
This actually has to do with another high-end retailer. Obviously, we talked about Coach during this episode of the podcast, but Nordstrom is now in the news as they have hired a new CFO, or Chief Financial Officer, in Anne Bramman. And she actually comes into the fold, says she's 49 years old, and the company had announced this here recently. And what's interesting is her background, Trent. If you look at the background, you have to go back quite a ways before you start seeing any real influence in the retail industry, because before the announcement here, she had actually worked and recently resigned from Avery Dennison Corporation, which is a maker of adhesive technologies and packaging material. So this is far different than the operations that Nordstrom has. However, if you look at potential CFO spots, you're saying that a lot of these openings aren't really contingent on your specific prior background. However, the financial performance of these companies. So for instance, if a CFO were able to turn a company around, that CFO might be able to do the same. It's more of the financial workings, not the management operational side of things. So it's not like she's going to be leading the strategy for Nordstrom social media or anything like that. But you do see some retail experience in the fold here. You look back at her prior experience. She was actually at L Brands for a period of time from about 2008 to 2010. So it appears as though she is no stranger to the retail industry, and she does come in with around 20 years of financial experience. So that's something to be said for a retailer that really needs some more emphasis on their financial side, as their previous CFO, Mike Koppel, had retired officially on May 1st of this year.
Well, my looking ahead story will very quickly look back as Tuesday morning announced their third quarter fiscal 2017 results before market open on Thursday morning, and the market reacted sharply to Tuesday morning. The share price had been bouncing around the $3.15 to $3.35 range and plummeted to as low as $1.90 on Thursday morning following Tuesday morning's earnings results. And you might think, based on the share price plummeting that far, that these earnings results were absolutely disastrous. And that's the interesting part, is that they really weren't all that bad or all that far off from expectations. They missed on earnings per share. Analyst estimates were for a loss of 31 cents. They ended up with a loss of 34 cents. But given the fact that they only missed analyst expectations by less than 10%, it's a little bit surprising to me that the stock took as much as a 40% hit in early trading on Thursday. Steve Becker, their CEO, mentioned changing up their supply chain. And since they've done that, and since they spent money changing up their supply chain, one of the reasons why they were less profitable than expectations had them, they've actually had positive comparable store sales over the last 2 months. Overall, for the three-month period, they did experience a comparable store drop by 2%. But again, there was an increase in the last 2 months of this period, and those were the first two full months under their new supply chain management system. In the off-price category where Tuesday Morning resides, supply chain can be everything. Customers don't want to go to a bargain hunt in a store that is absolutely empty. So I'm anxious to see, A, whether the market kind of bounces back with a little bit of optimism, at least, surrounding Tuesday Morning after just absolutely hammering them in trading during Thursday. B, if Tuesday Morning can represent some positive comps in the next quarter with this supply chain management system now fully in place, and see if they can turn around what over the last few years has been an unprofitable business as far as their bottom line is concerned. And see, something that Tuesday Morning mentioned in their earnings release is that they have relocated 44 stores during the past 12 months. They noted that sales at these relocated stores increased approximately 47% on average for the third quarter of fiscal 2017, the third quarter's results, what were released on Thursday Morning. So this is a more positive sign than the market price or the share price for Tuesday Morning reflected. And I think this could build into some positivity over the next few months for the struggling off-price retailer. That'll do it for the Retail Focus podcast for this week. For Layton, I'm Trent. As always, check out the Food Focus podcast if you don't subscribe already. We'll be discussing Applebee's and some of their struggles on the next episode of Food Focus. Check us out on Twitter at Retail Podcast. Subscribe on iTunes. If you like us, please do rate us as well. Until next week, so long.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.